and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Marcus Hippy.
On the show this week, Michael Winterbottom, the film and TV director lauded for his productions ranging from 24-hour Party People to The Trip. We'll be discussing why he's combining both documentary and drama in the new film On the Road.
We'll also be speaking to graphic designer Sarah Hindman. Her research into typography suggests that the font you fancy can reveal as much about you as your handwriting. We'll be seeing what type we are later.
And we'll be welcoming writer, publisher and entrepreneur Ben Aragundadi to talk about his latest book, Obama 101 Best Covers.
All that, plus Monocle's Bill Luty will be conducting a symphony of errors with the news. Look ahead. And we'll play you some great music too. That's all ahead on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
So, Tom, good catching up with you here at Midori House Studio One. I'm looking forward to the interviews we are having.
Listen, it's the only place I'd like to spend my Sunday lunchtime, Marcus. Not having a comfortable and cozy meal at home with my family. Mm-hmm. But here, in Studio One, locked, literally in, conversation with you, Marcus Hippy.
I wonder if we're going to be learning some useful lessons today. For example, I wonder if your habit of sending emails with Comic Sans font is going to change, go anywhere.
I thought that makes me a kind of jovial, jocular type.
Relaxed.
All may be revealed. I'll guarantee you someone from whom we were almost certain to learn literally nothing. It's Monocle's Bill Luty.
Which way you going, Billy? Can I go too? Which way you
So hello, Bill.
Hi, Marcus. Hi, Tom. Happy Sunday. How are you?
Bill, always good to see you. Did I lie convincingly then? No, I'm happy to see you.
I believe you.
It's a Sunday lunch bonanza on the Monocle Weekly. What does next week's news have in store for us?
Well, let's kick things off today. One of the biggest events in the European political calendar this year, the German election taking place. Germans are off to the polling station.
And Bill, plenty at stake. Mutti surely likely to be successful again.
Tell
us about what's the kind of general dynamics?
It was supposed to be exciting, wasn't it? Like a few months ago, everyone was like, Martin Schulz, he's the new guy coming in, he's smiley.
It's all been a bit friendly, hasn't it?
And then
but isn't that good, in a sense? Do we not want to see, there's so much polarity politically, you look in this country, what a bunch of deadbeats, you've got Trump in the White House. Isn't it rather nice to have two politicians going head to head, and actually they strike conciliatory tones, they talk amicably, there's broadly consensual agreement on things?
I think that's very refreshing, considering that we've seen so many elections in recent years where the tone hasn't been anything like that. So
grown-up politics.
Exactly,
grown-up.
And actually, I was reading an article about that. It was said that the German elections are a bit boring even, because there hasn't been the kind of controversy you've seen in many other countries, but that is, at least in my opinion, only positive.
I'd rather have boredom than Brexit.
Well, exactly. It's very German, isn't it?
Hey, I can work with it. At least you can get things done.
So the excitement comes with what coalition might form. It might be Martin Schulz, who might be in there as well. But, you know, there are plenty of other players in there. Moving on, but more politics, slightly less stable. Tomorrow, the Kurdish independence referendum is taking place. This is pretty controversial.
Now, that's, safe to say not everyone is going to be in agreement on that one. We're not going to see a consensual attitude.
No. Well, you know, you can see why. I think there's something like 35 million Kurds living in that area. It's pretty stable. It's, as far as like that region goes, it's doing quite well. There's quite good economy. There's not that much secular violence, you know, and they've been a huge help in the fight against ISIS, the Peshmerga. Yeah. And so, you know, they're very proud of who they are. They want to be able to show that by becoming a state. However, lots of people, most people, including the US, the UK and the UN, are suggesting it's probably not the right time to go about shaking things up.
Exactly. Just during the course of this week here on Monocle 24, we've been talking about how the Iraqi Prime Minister, for example, has formally demanded the suspension of the referendum. We also heard from Turkish President Erdogan, who was saying that he's willing to organise sanctions over the Kurds' independence bid and so forth. So it looks like the reception to the idea of this referendum around the region is not positive at all.
Yeah, and, you know, Haider al-Abadi is saying that even a polling station is an act of aggression. Hmm. Masoud Barzani is saying, we're just going to draw our own borders. So,
well, I was going to say, the semantics are interesting here because we have, there's referendums aplenty. You know, we talk about the Catalan referendum or other agreements, whether they're binding, non-binding. It's all well and good selling something, billing it as a referendum. But obviously, if it's not binding, and if almost by default, if you're not part of a state apparatus, you cannot be participating probably in a binding referendum. So it becomes more of a plebiscite or almost just a survey, which can add momentum to a campaign, but not necessarily advance an agenda. But nonetheless, it'll be very, very interesting.
Shall we move on? What else do you have for this coming week?
Something lighter. Who fancies a cup of tea or coffee?
Every day, Bill.
Please.
I know, because on Tuesday to Friday...
I thought you were offerings.
No, well, I'll just nip out and make one and then I'll come back in 5 minutes or something. Tuesday to Friday, the Tea and Coffee World Cup, which I think sounds slightly more exciting than it is.
Where does that take place?
It is in the Singapore Expo, so Singapore's largest exhibition centre. It brings together the tea and the coffee worlds, which I quite like, bringing those cultures together all the way from growing, roasting, all the way through to the little cup and drinking that delicious flavour.
I was going to ask you, Bill, about there's a traditional sort of animosity almost.
I think so.
Coffee, cat and dog, aren't they? Do the two tribes go at it like something from West Side Story?
Yeah,
or is it all amicable?
There's a giant fight. There's a huge stadium. No, I think they all get on. They get on well, you know. They're all here. Maybe if you want your caffeine. I don't know. There's a lot of... In this office, at least, because we've got lots of people from England, obviously, but lots of people from lots of different countries. You know, I'll be making a cup of tea and someone will come in and be like, you're so British. And, you know, there is... Between the drinkers, there's animosity. Perhaps behind, you know, the people that make the stuff... They're all just friends.
I'm fascinated by this event because obviously, for example, on Monaco's Food and Drink Show, the menu, we've been talking about many different barista competitions, but this is a World Cup when it comes to coffee and tea. I wonder how
is there a winner? It sounds like, how does that work?
Exactly.
I don't think there's a winner. I think, you know, the industry is the winner.
Everyone is a winner.
But there are lots of workshops. There's talks. There's something which... I was just looking up on the website. There's a cupping workshop.
Oh, have you booked your tickets already?
I don't know. There's plenty of those.
Is that what they mean by World Cup?
Oh.
Some sort of global reach around. Maybe we should leave it there. But anyway, anything else for us?
One more thing I wanted to hear. I know that you are busy preparing tea and potentially cupping at the Monaco kitchen. Any tips for a great cup of tea?
Yeah, warm the cup first.
Excellent.
Milk in first. Very divisive.
No, Tom.
Tea tastes less bitter that way.
Come on.
Marcus, back home in Silinjordavi. Tea or coffee?
Coffee. A lot of coffee. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of coffee.
No tea at all.
Not really tea. I mean, some individuals, but if you drink tea, you are a rarity.
I wonder what you're going to say then. Anything else for us, Bill?
Well, I like to do the world insert thing here day.
Oh, yeah.
We've got two.
Okay, hit me with them.
We'll do Tuesday coming up. That's the first one. Contraception Day.
How do you spend it?
Be safe, not sorry.
So, no, don't know what you want to do about that. The next one is Thursday, World Rabies Day.
Are the two connected?
I don't know. I didn't know this. One person every 10 minutes dies from rabies, so it is a problem, and it's very easily avoidable.
Okay, I can't make any jokes about that. That's a bit serious. Thanks for ending on an incredibly bleak note. Mine is a white tea, so if you can crack on with that in
the
meantime.
I'll be back in a bit. Marcus?
My favourite. Coffee, definitely black coffee. A double espresso, a triple espresso even. That's for me.
Jesus, that'll wake you up.
There we go. That's Bill Lutie. Thanks, Bill. We will be talking with film director Michael Winterbottom after this. Filmmaker Michael Winterbottom is a master of combining drama and reality to create something new. Whether it's the hard-hitting docudrama The Road to Guantanamo or the road trip improv comedy of The Trip TV series starring Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon, Winterbottom's created success out of blending fact and fiction to make a more vivid picture.
Well, his latest film does that again. It's a docudrama filmed during a tour by London indie rock band Wolf Alice. Romance unfolds, but it's interspersed with real situations faced by a band touring day in, day out. Monocle's Maddie Speed sat down with Michael a little earlier to learn more.
There wasn't really two separate operations in a way. We were sort of the two buses. It was like a two-bus tour. And our bus was mainly crew and the people working with us, but occasionally other people as well. Mm-hmm. And we basically just were like connected with an umbilical cord and had to suffer the same privations that they had to suffer.
How did the band react to your presence being there? Like, did they find it tricky having the camera in their face, or were they kind of...
We tried to be as discreet as possible. I mean, I like making films that are observational, even when they're fictional films, when we're with actors and the script. I still like to kind of let the actors get on with it and try and keep the camera kind of follow the actors and not disturb the environment, if possible. And so in this case, it's really a documentary in that most of the film is about the tour, it's about the crew. That was the starting point, is that what's it like to be on tour? What's it like to live on a bus? What's it like to live travelling, doing the same thing every day in a different place? But we had two actors to give us really a point of view on that. So one of them, which we sort of see the film through, is a young woman who's just started working with the management company. So she's been sent out to kind of help the band. So it's her first time on tour. And the idea is that we could be with Estelle, this character, and also with Joe, who's a member of the crew, and through them get to know the crew and the band from their point of view, which means within the kind of film, we also have like moments of when we're just with them by themselves, kind of the more intimate or personal aspects of the story with them. But really, we use them more to sort of see the band and the crew from their point of view.
Was it weird for, first of all, the band and the crew to have two actors there? And how did the actors adapt, and how did the band adapt to kind of having actors there? Was it jarring at first, or did they...
Yeah, I'm sure it was odd for the crew, especially probably to begin with. Joe, the character Joe, is like part of the crew. So really the actor James had to basically just work as a member of the crew the whole way through the whole of the tour. Estelle, because Estelle's job was like from the management company, so she was more hanging out with the band than just doing whatever was necessary. So the idea was they're both in character the whole time. They had to kind of do their jobs the whole time, and we followed them around. And I think, I'm sure it was strange, but I think, you know, in a way, it helped give a little bit of space between the camera and the band, or the camera and the crew. So it meant we weren't quite so much like with the band members themselves. We were more like with Estelle, with the band.
Yeah.
And so the, you know, what happened was, as the tour went on, Leo was playing Estelle. She, you know, her character got to know the band more, so we got to see the band through them. And James was playing Joe. His character got to know the crew more. So we were able to kind of use the actors as a sort of intermediary between us and the band.
Yeah, so Estelle, the character you're talking about, at one point she's on the bus and she's looking at the passing landscape and she says, wow, I want to go there. And like for me, that was really like illustrated the experience of the tour and the fact that you can go across the entire country and see nothing but, you know, the inside, the backstage or the inside of the venue. And I wondered if this like mundanity, like the anti-trope of like the tour not being glamorous, but it actually just being quite boring and quite monotonous, was something you wanted to examine with the film.
It's not totally different going away and making a film or going away on tour with a band, except that it's much, much harder on tour. Especially, you know, this is a kind of... When we started with the idea of making a film, we wanted it to be a band that's on a bus, you know, they're traveling on a bus and they, you know, they're touring a lot. So that there's an element of being confined to the bus, you know, and as you say, just seeing the world from inside the bus as it goes past outside or inside the venue. With a film crew, it's similar, but you have like a hotel, you have more time off and so on. And also, for me as a director anyway, like, film shoots tend to be about a couple of months long, you know, so whereas for the band, and particularly the crew, that's really their life. They, you know, they go from one to another.
Yeah.
At the end of the film, we have the list of where Joe's going in America, which is where the band were going.
Yeah.
It's just like an endless list of towns we're making. You say, oh my God, thank God we aren't filming that bit of the tour as well. I mean, I think there is something really warm about that world for them. But I kind of felt like also, you know, just that the hard work of it, the kind of claustrophobia of it, and also for me, I think probably just like the fact that you're isolated them from any other bit of your life. You know, in terms of your family, your friends, your lovers, whatever, it's very hard for them to kind of combine those two, to be with you. So if you're endlessly touring, in a way, that's kind of eating up the rest of your life outside the tour.
And how did you pick which band you followed? Did you always want to work with Wolf Alice, or did you have like a short list? Did you have anyone else in mind?
To be honest, I think when we first had the idea for doing a film like this, Wolf Alice was probably about 10 years old, so it wasn't always going to be Wolf Alice. We made a film ages ago called 24 Hour Party People, and when we were making that, we kind of were talking about it would be fun to actually do more filming with real bands. And then we showed it afterwards in New York one time, and there was a band called Ash who we met with afterwards, and we were in some bar in New York, and they were telling us about their life, and they were like, basically every night was a new city. They were touring all the time. They hadn't been home for months and months or years. And it just felt like maybe it was just being in New York and being late night in a bar. It seemed quite glamorous and romantic, but at the same time, weird. Really, from then, we'd always talked about maybe we should do something in that area. And then finally, we had like 6 months free, and okay, let's try and have a go at making the film. And then it was a question, okay, let's get a band that's quite young. I wanted a band that was touring Britain, I wanted a band that was living on a bus, I wanted a band that was like, you know, kind of great live band, you know, where we felt, in a way, in that kind of old fashioned tradition of touring and playing. And by chance, I happened to have lived at one point next door to Theo, the bassist, and my daughter had been to his class at school. So I'd heard probably a little bit more about Wolf Eyes. And then we met up with their manager, and he was keen, and he used to be the manager of Ash, so coincidentally. And Wolf Eyes are named after an Andrew Carter short story, and I, like Andrew Carter, I met a few times. I worked on a documentary once ages ago when I first started working. So it was like lots of little coincidences, and they're a great band, you know, and they were up for it.
So with this film and The Trip, 24 Hour Party People, 9 Songs, you play around with genre and you blur the lines between like fictional and real and documentary. And the narrative films often have that element of documentary style and like the loose scripts. Whereas this is a primarily a doc, which has a fictional element. So first I want to ask what your aim was in On the Road in fusing those two elements. And also, if this was potentially like a reaction to the times, to the supposed era of post-truth, or whether you really were just looking at it as like an interesting genre mix.
It's not for me a genre mix in this case. In the case of On the Road, it wasn't a genre mix, or even like I wanted to have fictional and fact in a way. What I wanted to do was capture that world is interesting. How can we, like, you know, let's film that world and try and capture what it must be like to be inside a tour, to be inside a group of people who are travelling and playing different places every night. But it felt to me that a straight documentary would, of course, be great with all the band stuff, great with the crowds, great with the crew getting the gear in, all that kind of public social stuff. You could, you know, you want to have a documentary. If you did a fictional version of that, it'd be awful. You know, trying to get fictional crowds, fictional music, fictional band, that'd be awful. So obviously, if you want to try and make a film in that world, all that public music stuff, all the work side of it, would be great as a documentary. But that's not the whole thing. The private things, the loneliness, the being away from your family, the be falling in love with someone, friends, having sex with someone, you're not going to get that in a documentary. It felt to me that if you want to have that intimate stuff and the personal stuff, then you had to have characters in there who were fictional. Yeah. And so it wasn't really wanting to play a genre, it's more like in order to try and capture the whole thing, you had to have both elements.
Yeah. I saw a review which I thought was quite interesting that basically said that while in 9 Songs you had a love affair with like a soundtrack, which was the music. On the other hand, On the Road, the love story of the soundtrack is the other way around.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think with 9 Songs, definitely the starting point was more the relationship. You know, 9 Songs is like a guy looking back on an affair that's finished where he loved the woman, but maybe the woman never loved him, he doesn't know. And I think, you know, for me, the music was partly just because I wanted to get away from narrative. I think love affairs really don't have much narrative. Like, you're in love with someone, then you're not. You know, this stops, it starts, and it stops. And I think one of the problems with films is they often give a lot of narrative to love story, which is then just like various plot devices and things that get in the way. Whereas music is brilliant, I think, at capturing feeling of being in love and, you know, and capturing the kind of mood you have. And often love songs are about love, you know, that's finished and over. And so, I think it was, as you say, the music was really there more because I think that expresses kind of what it's like to be in a relationship much better than film does. Yeah. And I wanted to just try and avoid narrative. Mm. Whereas this one, as I say, this was much more about like trying to be in the world in that kind of travelling circus. Really. Yeah. That was the starting point.
Yeah. Well, I guess for me, it's refreshing to see kind of a romance and a drama play out without those like tropes that you have to have in like a romance narrative, like the fall and the crisis point.
No, exactly. That's... Yeah, and obviously lots of relationships. Yeah, you know, it's like complicated area because obviously, it's, you know, most people spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, relationships and, you know, falling in love and falling out of love and being, you know, and falling in and out of relationships. And, you know, I do think films are just very bad at dealing with that for lots of different reasons. You know, but for narrative reasons, but also for prudishness about, you know, sex and so on. That it actually is an area where film is really sort of there's a very conventional pattern and tends to just be a variation on the same album.
That was Maddie Speed in conversation with Michael Winterbottom. On the Road, featuring the band Wolf Alice, is out on the 6th of October. Marcus, I feel it's time on the programme for some music. How would you feel about that? And given what we were just hearing about...
Oh, I know what you have in your mind. You want to play a song by Wolf Alice, don't you?
I do.
This is Don't Delete the Kisses.
Was Wolf Ellis from right here in London. The track was Don't Delete the Kisses.
What do you think that means?
I imagine is it to do with the, you know, the text messaging that all the young people do these days?
Oh, yeah, that's WhatsApping, or what they call it.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're talking typography next. Graphic designer Sarah Heinemann has been exploring the psychology of typography. If you think you don't have a type or that fonts don't have feelings, well, think about the last time you fell in love with a well-designed product. Could you love it just the same in Comic Sans, for example? I suggest probably not.
Sarah runs the Type Tasting Studio, an organisation dedicated to events and experiences that explore our relationship with typography. And she has also published books such as How to Draw Type and Influence People. Sarah joins us now to discuss what our favourite type says about us. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Sarah.
Thank you very much.
One of your core messages is that it's surprising how big of an emotional impact a font can have. Why is that?
Firstly, because when we're reading words, we do this really subconsciously. Our brains are so busy actually navigating what the words say that we relegate a subconscious bit of our brains to actually thinking about it, which means when we think that the fonts are quite invisible, actually they're not. We are picking up a huge amount of information that effectively creates a filter through which we then interpret the words.
So one thing that always strikes me as interesting, and I know there's references in your book from legends of the typographic space like Eric Speakerman, who's a friend of ours here at Monocle, of course, and there's always something that I find rather almost reassuringly old-fashioned about typographics. It makes me think of printing presses and the days of hot metal, which as an old journalist there always have a certain sort of allure. What about the way that the digital space is affecting this? Because so many people looking at things, I've got my phone and there's tablets and computers everywhere. Does that change those emotional reactions to fonts? Or actually, are some of those truths the same, whether it's on a screen or on a billboard or in a newspaper? How does that work?
This is something that's been debated for quite a while. There had been this idea that what you read on screen should be a modern sans serif, a simple typeface. But there has been quite a lot of research done these days that proves we have the same emotional reaction no matter what format or what you read it on, especially now that we're so used to reading either on paper or on a screen. We mix and match quite easily. There was a typeface developed by Dalton Marg for the Kindle, and they found that it was a serif, a more traditional book-style typeface that had the greatest emotional acceptance but was also the most readable. So we're now learning that you don't have to differentiate between the platform.
So what are your basic rules then? When someone has a message, how does that person choose the right font for that?
Think about the audience. What are you trying to say? It's exactly like, what outfit are you going to wear to an interview? If you're going to be interviewed for a job as a clown, wear your Comic Sans type.
that'll be more for you, Marcus.
right.
But it's always about thinking about the audience. It's, unless you're designing your own birthday invitation, it's not about our own personalities. So it's firstly, what kind of tone do you want to set? And then also, how do you want them to respond to you? Do you want them to think this is really easy to read? Do you want people to think, so looking through the Monocle magazine, the magazine is typeset in a very traditional book newspaper style. So very instinctively, you will assume that that is better researched, has more newsworthy, more information-worthy content in it. And you do this, and this filters what you read, so you will just make this assumption before you've even absorbed the information.
Sarah, tell us a bit about maybe some of the more possibly counterintuitive themes that you see quite often, because you see, for example, I always think of those very austere German newspapers, and they have this very sort of traditional typefaces, and you think of authority and austerity and seriousness. Are there any examples where, a bit like what I joked about Comic Sans, are there examples where actually it's different than that, and it doesn't follow that sort of almost instinctive or that more of the kind of cliched way of viewing things? Are there fonts that trip people up and can be a surprise almost? Or does it generally work according to those preconceptions?
The way you would use typefaces, fonts, would add layers of information. So if you want something to just say what it is, so you want to say the word cowboy and you want to just do it in cowboy typeface, you make the match. Whereas if you want to maybe it's a movie poster and you want to say this is set in outer space, you will say the word cowboy, but you will then use a very modern, clean, spaced out typeface that suggests science fiction. And you start layering up meanings like this. So we can do this so it makes sense, but every now and then there will be a time when actually that didn't work. And it's not so much that the typeface was the wrong typeface, it's just they're used sometimes in instances where they're considered inappropriate, which is where poor Comic Sans gets so much bashing.
It always gets a lot of stick, doesn't it? Yeah.
I stand up for Comic Sans.
When should you use Comic Sans?
There's no specific rule book, but children really like it. It's familiar to them. It was designed for Microsoft Bob, so it was designed for a cartoon dog. And there is a hint in the name, it's called Comic Sans. So you would use it in instances where that would be appropriate. Or else you use it ironically, or else you use it when you know that people are going to give you a lot of stick.
Comic Sans is such an example of you know, that font is getting so much bad rep. I wonder if all that, are people more aware of different fonts nowadays than they were before?
I think they are getting more aware, but that could just be that I've been talking to people for 4 years now, and there is now, I'm just noticing it. I think Comic Sans and Helvetica are probably the two most famous typefaces. So Comic Sans is almost like a gateway conversation. I can start you off. You can think, yes, I feel comfortable about this. You're not going to get lured into an academic conversation that's going to be intimidating. And then I'll sneak you into one.
Well, and on that theme, I know we talk about sort of psychology of typography, and I know you're very interested in, well, I don't really know what to describe it, sort of mass participation or almost like a census of typographic information. Tell me a bit about how you go about doing that, and I know you're keen for people to continue to contribute to it wherever they may be.
Yes. So when I started doing all of this about 4.5 years ago, my first question was, as a designer, do other people agree with the personalities I see in typefaces? And then do non-designers actually see the same typefaces? So I have an ongoing online font census, which is what I would love people to take part in. And this is gradually gathering up lots and lots of typeface profiles so that I can gradually build up really complex profiles, which I would love to put in a book so that people can start. So we can start classifying fonts according to their personalities and emotions instead of those very academic classification systems that seem quite impenetrable if you're not a designer.
Well, and just on that point, in terms of the education that people maybe should have, I don't know if you would look at it in those terms, about fonts and the way they engage with them. No, in the book How to Draw Type, for example, and Influence People, it's sort of presented as a kind of an activity book. I was having a few doodles myself. Do you think people, is that the best way to do it, to sort of have a go and actually try and, you know, train the hand to actually identify what the fonts are that you see? Is it just about being more aware of what's in the world around you? Are people, are they invested enough in the, admittedly, it's a barrage of fonts they see every day wherever they go. Do people need to be more, I don't know, aware almost of what's around them?
I think it's a joy to be more aware of it, because once you start looking around, you have so much fun. And any of you who've started debating it, you know we can endlessly talk about typefaces. But there are times when it is useful. If you're walking around a supermarket, you might end up with things in your basket, and actually it's worth having a think about, why did I choose these products? Mm. Maybe there are a few extra messages that have been built in, and it just gives you a little bit more choice or awareness of your choices. And you can still buy that chocolate because, mm-hmm, yes, it was a really decadent typeface and it lured you in, but you're doing it because you know that you're doing it as a choice almost.
Exactly. I wanted to discuss those perks with you. The name of your book is indeed How to Draw Type and Influence People, and the latter half of that is particularly fascinating. How much more successful or efficient could we potentially be if we knew our fonts better?
I think that especially food manufacturers, they already have a very, very good awareness of this. They work with consumer neuroscientists. You know, when you walk around a supermarket, that it's very well choreographed, that they know the nuances of how to tweak and change the message. But to us in our everyday lives, we can use it to have, if it's just you and I, we can use it to have fun when you're creating invitations or you're creating images for your Instagram feed. You can, rather than just saying something obvious, you can actually start layering up stories, mm-hmm, where you can use typefaces to say something extra.
If you were about to send us an email after this interview to, I don't know, thank for this interview, for example, what kind of a font would you choose, by the way?
Yeah. It depends how rude you are when I'm walking out of the room.
So let me ask, and I'm sure this is a question you get asked wherever you go, people must say, oh, this is good. What font would sum me up? You know, or, oh, you know me a little bit. You know, how would I best fill out my CV or something? What font should I use? And I guess it's inevitable we would look to, say, certain world figures, your sort of Donald Trumps, and say, oh, you know, is there a Trump? I mean, Comic Sans could rear its head again there. How easy is it? And again, I suppose it's a lot of fun to, I was going to say peg the font on the donkey, but you know what I mean? To align people that everybody knows with a font that sort of sums up their characteristics.
There are three questions there. I will answer one at a time. In terms of typefaces matching personalities and characteristics, we can, in a very light-hearted way, you can just say, oh yes, that person's quite comedic. What I've been doing with my font census is I ask people to choose certain keywords. And what I'm able to do is I take all the names off so I'm not being influenced by what I'm reading, and I can match these to things like Myers-Briggs personality profile outlines. And then, in a still a little bit tongue-in-cheek, I can then match those to different celebrities because it's all out there on Google which celebrities would be which categories. And some of those are really interesting. When I do that, the Queen comes up as Helvetica, as a typeface that works in service of the message, that isn't trying to have any big personality of its own. One of the ones that I found really interesting was there was one category that had two different typefaces. It had a combination of this really ornate, frilly script typeface, which was really seductive, but it also had this really angular, modern typeface called Clute that's really quite aggressive. And it was really unusual to have both of these typefaces in the same personality category. And then when I looked back and matched the celebs, the celebrities included people like Madonna and Donald Trump. And it was really interesting that the personalities were both seductive and, I guess, aggressive at the same time.
Yeah, that's a polite word. You could have used a much ruder one there. What's the end game of this, I wonder, Sarah? Is there a way that we could, I don't know, I'm thinking of colleagues upstairs who are sort of sifting through, you know, letters seeking employment, this sort of thing. A bit like, you know, you used to get those very scrupulous editors who say, oh, I won't read something that's got a mistake in it. Should we have an out tray where you just say, look, no, wrong font, I'm chucking that away without even opening it? Can we take this that far, or will there always be a bit of a grey area somewhere, do you think?
I think there will always be a bit of a grey area within parameters. You all know not to apply for a job at a top architecture firm in Comic Sans. We all know that there are certain parameters. But within that, we all have our personalities. And I think now that we're getting more and more used to seeing type on so many different platforms, that we're becoming a little bit more forgiving about it in the same way that we have done with photography. But what I think we're also seeing is there's almost a homogenization of type. A lot of what you see now is this kind of app style, very, very clean, very modern typography, and we're losing a little bit of the personality. So to me, my end game is to let's get designers to use a wider range of personalities and broaden out the different tones of voices that we use.
Which fonts would you like to point out that would deserve more attention?
It depends entirely on the context. I think we get new revivals of old typefaces, and the good type foundries, they will take them and then bring them up to date. So something like Johnson's Railway Sans, which is over 100 years old, has recently been modernised, so it has all of the new glyphs, the new characters in it that we would want to use. There was an amazing project by a student. I was a DNAD judge for the Students Award 2 years ago, and this student had found these missing letters from an old, I think it was a Russian style of alphabet, that had basically been taken out. So she found a way to actually bring these back and recreate this alphabet with these missing letters reinstated. And it brought this whole history flooding back in this single typeface, which I thought was quite beautiful.
It's almost like there's a sort of an archaeological quality. Are there the great unearthed types? Are there sort of foundries where there are these things that we think they're there, but they're not there? Is there a bit of a mythology around some of these fonts?
There is a wonderful mythology because they are so much a part of our everyday lives. There were the Doves type, letterpress type, which were thrown into the Thames. And then in the last few years, somebody very carefully sent some divers down and they found these old metal types. You also have these amazingly beautiful ornate letters by Louis-Jean Pouchet that were Victorian. They're the most opulent, decorated letters ever that you would have seen them on the pulp You would have seen them on the Pulp album cover. They got hidden. All the other printers in London decided to sort of gang up on Pouchet and they hid his letters. And it was only in the last 10, 20 years that James Moseley from the St. Bride Library found them in a dusty garage and has brought them back to life again. So the stories of typefaces, because they're from type foundries and they used to have be in competition with each other, are really quite amazing.
It's an amazing tale, and Sarah, we could talk to you about it all day. Just remind us one last time, so people want to take part and participate in the mass type census. How do they go about it? They head to the site, give us
the
details.
They come to my website, which is typetasting.com, and they head for the font census. I will make sure it's really obvious how to get there on the website.
Well, I was going to say, wayfinding must be very important if you're talking with authority in this line of business. Sarah, great to speak with us. Thanks for coming on the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much.
During his two terms in power, President Barack Obama was on the covers of many magazines and newspapers, maybe more, in fact, than any president in history.
Well, writer, publisher and entrepreneur Ben Arukundadi has compiled all the best covers in the new book, Obama, 101 Best Covers, and he joins us in the studio now. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Ben.
Thank you.
So, could you start by telling how this all began, your fascination with these front covers featuring Barack Obama?
Yeah, well, as you probably know from all these things, the beginnings of these things are accidents. The discovery of penicillin, me doing these books, you're kind of doing something else, and then suddenly an accident happens. So I was in Times Square on election night on another job. I'm ashamed to say I should have been there for him, but I was doing something else. And the hotel was on the edge of Times Square, so I found myself in the square on election night with all the euphoria. And then the next day, everybody, after the shocking, amazing result, sensational result, were out collecting covers with him on the front as commemorative keepsakes. And I got caught up in the melee of that and collecting things. But I didn't know what it was going to be for then, so destiny hadn't hit me. And then later on, as I started collecting them, I thought, well, this has got to be some kind of commemorative book where we corral, sort of curate them all together and then create something. But the very difficult and inconsiderate thing Obama did was he won the second term, which meant the book was another 4 years late. I could have done it in 2012 if he'd lost.
No respect for publishing deadlines.
Inconsiderate.
I wanted to ask you a bit about the chronology, actually, because obviously, as you go through the book and you go back to that weight of history that seemed to be there with those early covers, all the newspapers, this sort of thing. Now, Obama's legacy is obviously still forming, and I was joking before we started the conversation about my nostalgia for the Obama era, given who we have in the present incumbent in the White House. Over that period of time, though, he faced lots of difficulties, and the jury's out on how much he could get done, how much he was hamstrung by domestic politics and this kind of thing. As you chart the covers through the 8 years, is that reflected in subject matter, in the depictions of Obama? Because one thing that strikes me is that he continued to look always very presidential, very untroubled, even when he was having political problems. Did you detect a change? There seemed to be an amazing kind of consistency about his presentation on them.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting narrative, because when you line up 8 years of covers and you start to see patterns and you realise that because he was the first non-white president, he was under probably more pressure and more scrutiny than he would have been if he was white. That's quite clear when you see what happened. And so within that, it's quite remarkable that he actually did manage to hold it together to that extent when you look at what happened. But the interesting pattern with the covers is at the beginning, you see how the press basically fitted him up to be something that was impossible, because he was the first black person. They thought he would be the Messiah, the Superman, the black Jesus, that he would basically save America and the world. Of course, when he didn't do that, people were disappointed. So it's almost like it's a similar situation that happened to Jackie Robinson in the 40s, when the first black person breaks through in baseball, they expect you to be super. You can't just be a man. You have to be Superman. And the same was true here. And so it really is a test, ultimately, of your ability to kind of be cool, knowing that that's going to be the pressure, you know?
And he certainly always wore, at the risk of being rather glib about this, he seemed to always wear that pressure rather lightly. And you talked about retaining his cool and being cool, and he managed to do that seemingly effortlessly, although I'm sure swan-like he was having to work pretty hard to retain that demeanor. Do you think Obama was a bit of a dream for your art directors, for your snappers, for your people who are picking front page images and designing front pages of magazines? Was he an exciting canvas, do you think, for people to work with, or was it a challenge because it was unprecedented?
I mean, if you look at the breadth, the length and breadth of different characters in the book, he was an absolute dream for newspaper magazine editors. I mean, if you look through the covers, he's depicted as Superman, the Messiah, George Washington, FDR, a Jew, Hindu deity, Lord Shiva. I mean, an incredible length and breadth of different characterizations from people who were either A, confused about what he stood for in 2008, or secondly, the expectations were so broad that it wasn't going to be impossible for him to meet even kind of a fraction of them. So when you look at them all together, you can see how much fun, if you like, the art directors had in creating these kind of fictional personas.
I would imagine that was quite a job for you to try to decide which 101 covers to include in this book. How did you make that decision? And do these 101 have something in common?
Yeah, it's a very difficult decision, and people argue with me, why didn't you put this one in, why didn't you put that one in and stuff. And in the end, these things are highly personal. In the final edit, my criteria was try and pick the ones where something creative is happening. They're trying to say something specific with the execution. So the covers where he's just kind of standing there looking at the camera didn't really get chosen because there wasn't really anything particularly interesting about them, I didn't think. So I tried to gravitate towards the ones where something particularly interesting was being done and then just take out the rest. So in the end, I've still got, I don't know, 600 of them at home that didn't make it, wrapped in plastic in the attic. I don't know.
Volumes 2, 3, 4, 5. It's good.
If you had to choose one or two favourites.
You can't ask that question. That's like choosing your favourite
children.
That's
what the guests say when I ask this question, not you, Tom.
What do you reckon? Is there one that just seems to embody the whole of the sort of Obama era?
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, in if I'm going to choose one, I would choose the inauguration edition of Time magazine, which has Obama on the front being sworn in with one hand on the Lincoln Bible, because that is the startling, shocking moment when a black man is elected president of a country which grew up with the culture of slavery. And so 220 years earlier, when America's first president, George Washington, was sworn in 220 years ago, African-Americans were all slaves. 220 years later, there's a black president. 220 years is no time in terms of how civilizations move and rise and fall, et cetera, et cetera. So that is arguably the most powerful image in the history of the country, that this guy has got his hand on the Lincoln Bible and he's been sworn in. That's the picture that went all around the world on all the front pages. And so if I'm going to pick one, I think it's going to be that one for the sheer historical power and importance of that moment.
Ben, what strikes me as interesting there about that is you mentioned 220 years, then there was Obama, and then only 8 years later, and Trump again. And obviously, you know, the jury, well, it's not really out. I mean, we kind of know what he's about. He's probably a big racist. He's a misogynist. Was there anything from studying the media that accompanied Obama during those 8 years that could have in any way prepared us for that happening? Because it seems, is it a reaction to the fact that we had a boundary breaker in the White House? It seems so improbable that we could be having the conversation about someone like Trump in 2017, having had those 8 years and that astonishing emotional moment. Did you get any sense from looking back over your archive how that can possibly have come about?
After Obama, you do, because, you know, once a black man's been elected, then anything's possible after that. So he breaks the mold. So the 43 presidents before him were all one ethnicity, one gender, and one kind of presidential stereotype, if you like, in terms of their behaviour. And then after a black man, anything's possible. So a woman runs for president after that, Hillary. Then an outsider wins, Trump. And so, of course,
I suppose if you look at him as an outsider rather than those pejorative pronouncements I made, it
exactly.
Kind of makes more sense, doesn't it?
Trump is the opposite end of what the outsider means. Mm. And so, of course, Obama is the first person to break that open. So it makes sense that it would happen then. What's interesting, I suppose, is what it says about the culture that we're living in, that actually something has changed for people to elect a black president and then to swing to somebody like Trump. So the timing of that in terms of where we are in history is very interesting. So it didn't happen 20 years ago. So there seems to be something about the way culture has moved now that other possibilities like this can happen.
On a hopefully more positive note, after having gone through so many magazine covers, do you feel like you learned something also about how media works? how publishing scene works.
Yeah, if you look at the examples, for example, of the news weeklies, things like New York or Time magazine, often the covers are illustrations created by in-house artists, and often they're designed to be controversial. With print being under such pressure to survive now, they have to produce covers that are going to get headlines so that they can get the attention that they want. And so what you see in those covers is they're very, very sensationalist. And so they always tend to push the envelope in the hope that a cover will go viral or it will end up being a talking point on national news or something like this. And so the covers that are in that kind of group always had a very hyped up agenda. And so if you put them next to the covers where they're just sort of straight photographs of Obama, art directors can do less with that. And so often the call seems to be, if we can't get our narrative in a photo, we'll draw it instead and then create it that way.
What about, Ben, depictions of African Americans or Black British, or I guess if we look across Western media and depiction of ethnic minorities, certainly on front pages, there's been a lot of ongoing controversy about that, whether it's depictions or, you know, inaccurate societal depictions of groups of people on magazine covers, they're not being representative enough, this sort of thing. We had a big narrative around the Edinful appointment at Vogue, of course, and looking to freshen up what some people said was it was a pretty uniquely white group who was putting that paper together. If you looked at that last staff picture just before the changeover here in London, to sort of follow on from what Marcus said, has this sort of helped you understand certain media models? You know, do we have a problem in certainly in mainstream media with depictions of and the representation of ethnic minorities? You know, is it still a business that's completely dominated by your, you know, white, middle-aged, middle-class types?
I mean, in terms of, for example, the frequency with which non-white people make the covers of mainstream magazines, there still is a problem. But if you think about it, whose problem is it? So most of the heat has been directed to the publishers. You know, why doesn't Anna Wintour have more Black people on the cover of Vogue or whatever it is? But it's really about us. It's about the consumers. Because if a Black person's on the cover of a magazine and then people buy fewer copies of that magazine because that face is Black, then the problem is with the consumers, not with the magazine itself. And so what we have to understand is, what is the reaction that would make somebody not buy their favorite magazine because the person on the cover is brown? So at what point are we striking at the inner subconscious racism of a particular reader or so? And now that we're in an era in which you can have, say, Obama on the front cover of something and it doesn't harm sales. In fact, it boosts it. You think, wow, so what's happening there? So, in other words, if you're Black, you have to be really popular. You have to be kind of bulletproof.
That is always a trickier, to look at it from that consumer perspective, it's more challenging analytically.
Absolutely.
And it's also harder to do anything about. Is it not fair enough to say, well, hang on, they need to be more publishers, editors, or whatever it might be, who are willing to... And it's not even a question of being bold. It's just a question of doing the right thing. I mean, it's fair enough to ask that, isn't it? Of whether it's Anna Wintour or anyone else for that matter.
Absolutely. But the right thing morally may not be what a publisher might consider to be the right thing financially. So the key factor for them is, don't lose money. Don't lose money on cover sales. Don't lose money on advertising revenue, whatever you do. And so if a magazine sells fewer copies when someone's Black on the cover and you're going to lose some money, they will try to do it as infrequently as possible, you know, just to try and kind of cover that off. Which is why sometimes Black people used to be on the covers of the January editions, which are usually the skinniest in terms of pages and have the fewest amounts of advertising because of the Christmas thing. So they used to just put Black people in front of that one and just kind of then get that done. But I think now, as people are perhaps looking, if dare I say, beyond race with covers, you know, you might argue that someone like Beyonce, for example, has an audience which is kind of colorblind, which is buying into her because of who she is and what she can do as opposed to her ethnicity. So I'm not saying we're there yet, but
that's an encouraging shift, given we talked about Trump
way.
And all stuff.
Yeah,
you're encouraged that is at least a process.
Absolutely.
That we're on.
New generations, less racist, newer generations, young people, you know, seeing personalities.
But then with
Trump,
and with the Brexit vote, you know, are we sometimes I worry that there's a generation that's you know, as racist or in some cases more racist than before? How do those big things happen if that is the journey we're on? Or do we just have to accept that we're still making progress, even if it's not at the pace that we're
going? I think we are. But, you know, we're always surprised by what young people do. You know, we were surprised about how young people came out and voted Labour because people have kind of written them off. But, you know, these are the people that are defining the next generation. And so actually, us oldies who own stuff and own media and own magazines, sometimes we don't understand how youngsters are actually more forward-thinking than we are when it comes to stuff like that. And optimistically, I think the next generation of youngsters are going to be less bothered about whether somebody on the front of the cover of a magazine is one colour or the other. They're going to be more interested in the culture of what they do and the tribalism of what they do and the sound of what they do or the acting that they do, whatever it is.
Well, finally, Ben, I'm wondering, after 8 years of collecting magazines with Barack Obama on the cover, are you going to keep on shopping? And secondly, what's happening to the magazine collection? It must be quite big.
Yeah, I'm not sure what to do with it. It's in the attic. They're all wrapped in plastic. You can't do anything with the outtakes, really. It's like when you bring out a magazine which says Unseen Obama, it really means it's the covers that were not good enough to make the real magazine. So you can't really use them for anything. Maybe I'll just have a big exhibition and just chuck them all in and that might be the solution.
Sounds good. Let us know where it is and we'll come along. Oh, sounds
great.
Good to me.
There you go. You're getting for free. Thank
Ben,
you.
That's very kind. It's been an absolute pleasure. Good luck with the book. Remind our listeners where they can get hold of a copy because it's sort of printed to order. That's how it
that's
works,
right.
Isn't it? Tell us how they do it.
Print on demand. Printed to order proposition, the new lean way of publishing books. So we only print when you order one, so there's no waste, no books sitting on pallets in warehouses, etc., etc. So it's leaner and meaner and uses less paper. So you can get them at www.whitelabelsbooks.com, and then from there they'll be linked to get one. So thanks very much.
Great stuff. Ben, thanks for coming to see us. Great. And joining us on the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
And that's almost all for this week's edition of the Monocle Weekly. This hour went really fast, Tom.
It absolutely flew by, Marcus.
And lessons were learned when it comes to typography or when it comes to magazine covers.
You need to stop sending out your CV in Comic Sans. That's why you're not getting any
what
of the
did you
jobs
learn? What did you learn?
Applying for. I learned
some
about...
Some cupping tips.
I learned about cupping from Bill Lutie, which I didn't want to. But now that's burned into my mind forever. And it was brilliant, Marcus, to hear from Michael Winterbottom. I'm a huge fan of some of his works, The Trip, other favourites like that. Fascinating to hear from a real sort of legend of the silver screen and the small screen as well. Really fascinating. I do encourage readers to get hold of Obama 101 Best Covers, because that's an amazing sort of resource, an encyclopedic look back at...
A great recap of the past 8 years.
His appearances on various front pages and front covers.
And,
stuff.
And as we heard from Bill Lutie in the beginning of this programme, next week is going to be obviously quite busy here on Monocle 24 as well. Plenty to talk about.
Indeed. Let's thank the people, though, Marcus, behind the... Well, I should say thanks to you, Marcus, first of all.
Thanks to you, Tom. I can tell you that this was the edition number 429 of the Monocle Weekly, by the way.
It was produced by Tom Hall and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Research by Jonathan Whitfield and Katie Watkins. Our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. My thanks, Marcus, to all of them.
Exactly, mine too. The Monocle Week will be back again next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Marcus.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Bye-bye.